Well, we want to come back and talk about the United States entering World War II. Remember that in 1917 there had been a Selective Service Act. And what does Franklin Roosevelt do in 1940? He begins a peacetime draft. This was just a definite genius move. We mentioned in our last lecture about the Atlantic Charter being signed between the United States and Britain off the coast of Newfoundland. And some of Wilson's 14 points were kind of renewed, you know, in scope and chatted about. I mentioned the four freedoms in the last lecture, okay? And remember, in the election of 1940, it'll be decided, and most people were okay with Franklin Roosevelt breaking the two-term tradition set by George Washington and running for a third term. Well, what does Hitler do in 1940-41? Germany violates that non-aggression pact and attacks Russia. Russia, a communist country, is going to end up being an American ally. And Franklin Roosevelt called Joseph Stalin, the communist dictator, Uncle Joe. You know, think about it. It's a softer term. In your family, you might have somebody that not everybody likes, and you kind of, you know, watch out for it. And in this way, Uncle Joe was kind of a family member, an ally, but you just were aware of him, and you tried to work together as best you could, but you just remember that he was of a different bent than you were. But because Germany violated that non-aggression pact, that made it very easy for the Soviet Union, Russia, to become an American ally. Well, here's the scene. The British are running out of money. Cash and carry is not going to work anymore. Destroy your bases are not going to work anymore. Remember that January 1941 speech I was telling you about in the last lecture? Franklin Roosevelt, wow, he just introduces something new. And he introduces something called Lend-Lease to the American people. Lend-Lease is going to be the plan to help the British and the Allies fight against the Nazis. Winston Churchill never gave the National Socialist Party or the Nazis equal recognition. In meetings, he always called them Nazis. Oh, those Nazis. So just a little slang term during the war. But Lend-Lease is going to be begun to help supply the Allies. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt wanted the United States to be the great arsenal of democracy. And Lend-Lease is going to provide tanks and trucks and aid in exchange for 99-year leases on British military bases. And Franklin Roosevelt captions this to the American people like this. In the fall of the year, if you're raking leaves and your neighbor is raking leaves, and then all of a sudden there's a fire in your neighbor's leaf pile, doesn't it make sense to lend him a hose? Because, in essence, if that fire spreads, it's going to end up in your yard. So better to take measures ahead of time to ensure that maybe that doesn't happen. Well, so Hitler's fighting a two-front war by 1941. The British and eventually the Russian peoples and the Russian government will be accepting Lend-Lease aid. And then, of course, you have the attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. Across the international dateline, in the Philippines, it was December the 8th. Well, this was just a shocking day. I mean, there's no other way to say it. It was a Sunday afternoon in America, and you know, people were listening to the radio. A lot of times there would be a symphony playing or a football game, and you know, a lot of people remember where they were when they heard about Pearl Harbor, and you know, taking place just around 8 o'clock in the morning. on December 7th in Oahu, Hawaii. I asked my grandfather where he was, if he remembered where he was, or what his memory was of Pearl Harbor. And, you know, he couldn't exactly remember right away, but my grandmother did, because when we were having this conversation, she immediately, without saying a word, just went, "Ugh!" You know, and I happened to ask my grandmother this about 55 years after the end of the war, and it was still fresh in her mind. I'll never forget that moment with my grandmother. Well, I'm going to tell you, December 8th, 1941, in Washington, D.C., was a monumental day. Franklin Roosevelt gets up. He has written a speech. He is going to travel from the White House to the Capitol to give a speech that is essentially going to declare war on Japan. He's very nervous. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt had 10 pounds of steel on each leg. He's very nervous that he's going to get into the House of Representatives chamber and walk down the aisle towards the podium and slip and fall while he's holding the arm of his son, who happens to be a naval officer. It was said he was sweating bullets by the time he got to the podium. And the government that was so nervous that the Japanese were going to somehow assassinate the president, leaving the White House to the Capitol, that they were able to acquire Al Capone's bulletproof car to make sure the president could get safely from the White House to the Capitol. Ah, to hear that language of the speech yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. And Roosevelt goes through the litany of attacks that the Japanese had launched in places like Wake Island and Guam and Puerto Rico and the Philippines. And then he asked Congress for a declaration of war. And within an hour, the U.S. Congress has declared war on Japan. Because Japan and Italy and Germany had signed the Rome-Berlin-Tokyo Axis, on December 11th, Hitler also declares war on the United States. And again, it took only an hour for the U.S. Congress to declare war back on Germany. It was a pivotal couple days. It really was. Later that month, Winston Churchill braves the Atlantic hurricane season, and he travels across the Atlantic, and he not only braves the hurricane season, but he braves the German submarines to meet with the American president, who is now a wartime president. And Churchill spends several weeks at the White House as the planning for World War II takes shape. It'll be an incredible time, an incredible time. And these two leaders did not always agree, but they had a great relationship, and they worked well together, their staffs work well together, and they could find some common ground. Well, you know, what was life like on the home front? Very quickly, after Pearl Harbor, the United States Army decides it's important to round up Americans of Japanese descent, because the feeling is, and the talk is, that some of these Americans of Japanese descent are going to end up being spies. So Franklin Roosevelt, against the advice of a lot of people, will sign Executive Order 9066, and this will begin the roundup of Americans of Japanese descent. I think the toughest story for me that I've heard out of this is a gentleman talking about his Japanese-American friend who is in elementary school class with him. And they're going to school just about every day. They're saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And then one day, his friend, who happens to be an American of Japanese descent, is gone. His family has lost their home. His family has lost their business. And they're being evacuated to places like Heart Mountain, California. Or the closest one to us would be Arkansas. If you're a fan of the original Star Trek series, George Takei, who plays Mr. Sulu, was a young boy at the time at the internment camp in Arkansas. And some great videos online about that if you care to look at it. Also, again, we're moving from butter to guns, okay? And factories are retooling for war. Eventually, Henry Ford's Willow Run plant will encompass 2 miles of assembly line. Wow. And from 1943 to 45, there'll be no cars made in America. There'll be simply tanks and planes and something new called the Jeep. There'll be Liberty ships being built, okay, by Henry Kaiser. Henry Kaiser is the gentleman who really gets the Liberty ships to take off. Eventually, at a plant in New Orleans, there'll be the Higgins boat plant. And Andrew Higgins will design the landing craft vehicle personnel that will, you know, bring men onto the shore of Normandy on June 6, 1944, the landing craft. And today, in New Orleans, on the site of that Higgins plant, is the National National World War II Museum. And it is an impressive, impressive place. One of the things that Andrew Higgins did is that he hired anybody that wanted to work. He paid them the same, whether you were a woman or a male, or whether you were black or white. You know, that's pretty awesome. One of the things that occurs during World War II also is the Double V campaign. And if you are a minority in America, you practice the Double V. Not only victory over totalitarianism and Hitler and all his mess, but also you wanted victory over racism and discrimination at home. And that was a powerful, powerful movement. Around late 30s, early 40s, A. Philip Randolph, the chair of the union called the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. These were African Americans who handled your luggage on the train. And A. Philip Randolph threatens a march on Washington because black men and women aren't being paid the same. They're being discriminated in defense jobs. And so he threatens a march on Washington. And of course, what does Franklin Roosevelt do in return, who did not want to see scores of people marching on Washington, D.C. as the war is heating up? Franklin Roosevelt signed something called the Equal Opportunity Act that begins to ban racism in the defense industries. It doesn't cure racism, but it's really the beginning of an idea, and that is a march on Washington for jobs and freedom. And on August 28, 1963, 18 years after the end of World War II, I think I did my math right, you're going to have the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And, of course, who is the 10th speaker that day? Quite a unique American, and that's Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who will give what becomes to be called his I Have a Dream speech. Well, talked a little bit, and you can see how wonderfully interesting this topic is, but it's not an easy topic. You know, Americans of Japanese descent are in internment camps by 1942. There'll be an important court case called Korematsu versus the United States that shows itself in 1944. And the Supreme Court upheld the legality of the internment camps, but also maintained that if Americans of Japanese descent in these camps were loyal Americans, then they had the right to leave the camps. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan will apologize for, you know, Franklin Roosevelt's executive order, the president, Ronald Reagan, in the 1980s. And the U.S. government will attempt to give about a $25,000 payment to these Americans who had been interred illegally. And, you know, people still call it the worst civil rights violation in America. You know, and that begs the question, does thousands of dollars of money, erase the hardship and the treatment? Maybe it does. I don't know. Here's what we know about the internment camps, and that is Americans of Japanese descent were wonderful people. They organized their culture. They were strong in their families and in their beliefs. They organized movie theaters and all different kind of things to make life a little bit better in these camps. And of course, one of the things that saved some people, particularly young boys in these camps, was the game of baseball. And baseball was played often in different leagues within these camps. And there's some good movies and some good books about that. Well, when we return, we're going to talk about the theaters of war. And then we'll try to have one more lecture on just the memory of the war. Hey, thanks.